Culture of Corruption, Obama and His Team of Tax Cheats, Crooks, and Cronies, by Michelle Malkin. Narrated by Johnny Heller. Copyright 2009 by Michelle Malkin. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Regnery Publishing and was produced in the year 2009 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Introduction. All hail the Achievatrons. Phew! Janitors in newsrooms across America worked overtime in the halcyon days after Barack Obama won the presidency. It wasn't easy cleaning the drool off laptops and floors in the offices of journalists covering the greatest transition in world history. New York Times columnist David Brooks laid claim to the most soaked keyboard and stained carpet in the business. He praised Team Obama's open-minded individuals and admired professionals. He raved about their post-partisan rhetoric and practical creativity, and ooh la la, how about the brains of all those brainy brainiacs? So smoking hot. This truly will be an administration that looks like America, or at least that slice of America that got double 800s on their SATs. Even more than past administrations, this will be a valedictocracy. Rule by those who graduate first in their high school classes. If a foreign enemy attacks the United States during the Harvard-Yale game at any time over the next 4 years, we're screwed. Already, the culture of the Obama administration is coming into focus. Its members are twice as smart as the poor reporters who have to cover them, three times if you include the columnists. They typically served in the Clinton administration and then, like Cincinnatus, retreated to the comforts of private life. That is, if Cincinnatus had worked at Goldman Sachs, Williams and Connolly, or the Brookings Institution. So many of them send their kids to Georgetown Day School, the posh, leftish private school in D.C., that they'll be able to hold White House staff meetings in the carpool line. It had only been 17 days since Election Day, but the president-elect, complete with his own Office of the President-Elect logo, and his team of valedictocrats, armed with their Ivy League degrees, had already bowled Brooks over with their organizational prowess. And yet, as much as I want to resent these overeducated achievatrons, not to mention the incursion of a French-style government dominated by highly trained enarchs, I find myself tremendously impressed by the Obama transition. Most of all, they're picking Washington insiders, or to be more precise, they are picking the best of the Washington insiders. As a result, the team he has announced so far is more impressive than any other in recent memory. Believe me, I'm trying not to join in the vast heaving euphoria now sweeping the coastal haute bourgeoisie, but the personnel decisions have been superb. The events of the past 2 weeks should be reassuring to anybody who feared that Obama would veer to the left or would suffer self-inflicted wounds because of his inexperience. He's off to a start that nearly justifies the hype. And Brooks's employer has profited mightily from the hype. Celebrating Obama's 100-day mark, New York Times reporter Jennifer 8 Lee exulted that the financially troubled Fish Wrap of Record had sold $2 million worth of Obama-themed merchandise. The Times has a vested financial interest in propping up the Obama administration. At ABC News, former Democrat operative turned objective newsman George Stephanopoulos also exhibited the symptoms of the Obama transition's salivary gland stimulus. We haven't seen this kind of combination of star power and brain power and political muscle this early in a cabinet in our lifetimes, Stephanopoulos dribbled. After blotting his chin a bit, he added, he's managed his transition with the same kind of precision and discipline that he managed to show during the campaign. It's hard to imagine this transition going much better for the president-elect. The Washington Post and Newsweek both indulged in transition mania, launching websites featuring by-the-minute blogging of Barack Obama's historic and unprecedented ascension to power. The New York Times told the story of how the savvy Obama made a phone call 13 days before the election to send a feeler out to General James Jones for the National Security Advisor post. 13 whole days, as if no other incoming president over the last 232 years had come up with the genius concept of reaching out to potential nominees before Inauguration Day. This used to be called planning ahead. In the most historic and unprecedented incoming administration in our lifetimes, Obama's phone call was hailed as a visionary advance mobilization for the benefit of Western civilization. An inconvenient aside, for all the hype about the greatest transition in world history, Obama failed to beat the pace of the Reagan White House. By day 100, Obama had 65 officials confirmed, Reagan had 73. And the evil Republicans did it without all the bungles and baggage that the angels of Obama brought with them. Obama's a faster turtle, but he's still a turtle, transition analyst Paul Light observed, his voice of reason drowned out amid the media frenzy. Journalists and cable TV talking heads chattered endlessly about Obama's record speed on the one hand and his exhaustive vetting process on the other. Application forms ran on for 7 pages and 63 questions, the New York Times marveled. The Bush-Cheney vice presidential application form was 200 pages. But when Republicans require rigorous background checks, it's not exhaustive, it's a paranoid invasion of privacy. But I digress. President-elect Obama next dispatched hundreds of meticulous agency review team members, 135 people divided into 10 groups, along with a list of other advisors, into the bowels of the federal government. Their mission? To rigorously examine programs and policies and expedite the transfer of power. The transition team leaders wore smart yellow badges on the job with "Yes, we can" do attitudes to match. Awestruck, Good Morning America anchor Robin Roberts of ABC News echoed the conventional wisdom. Some would say it's a team of rivals, a la President Lincoln, or is a better comparison a team of geniuses, as FDR did. I wrote this book to give you the exhaustive answer that President Obama's gyrating media harem doesn't want you to read. Crony, William Sapphire tells us, comes from 17th century college slang at Cambridge University in England. The word is rooted in the Greek Chronios, long-lasting, from chronos, time. Sapphire traced its etymological evolution in the United States. Crony took on a pejorative connotation as the sinister side of friend, more of a hanger-on, the recipient of favors for old time's sake. In 1946, when President Harry Truman's poker-playing friends brought disrepute on his administration, the New York Times columnist Arthur Kroc wrote that New Dealers and conservatives found themselves together in opposition to what a press gallery wit has called a government by crony. Obama's team, the best of the Washington insiders, as David Brooks called it, is a dysfunctional and dangerous conglomerate of business-as-usual cronies. They play basketball with the president now instead of poker, but they are every bit as disreputable and demanding as their 1940s counterparts. The administration is teeming with long-lasting favor-seekers in government, business, and the lucrative bridge in between. The corruption stretches from wealthy power brokers like Rahm Emanuel and Valerie Jarrett to pay-to-play tainted Michelle Obama and Joe Biden to ethically challenged, bailout-bungling money men Larry Summers and Tim Geithner at Treasury, crime-coddling corporate lawyer Eric Holder at DOJ, to the crooked Service Employees International Union, the shakedown artists at the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, and the ever-expanding swamp of Washington lobbyists. This book puts together the familiar and not-so-familiar pieces of the transition and crisis to force Obama hagiographers to confront an alternate narrative, a reality-based narrative, a narrative of incompetence, nepotism, influence peddling, and self-dealing that defies the stubborn myth that Barack Obama is the one true agent of hope and change. While pundits cooed over Obama's achievatrons and their unbridled star power, nomination after nomination imploded. The White House and its allies dismissed each failure as a hiccup, a bump in the road, or a goof. Meanwhile, the pace of withdrawals and botched appointments was record-setting and unprecedented. Some of the names you'll recognize, some you've never heard of because Obama's cheerleaders were too busy glorifying the greatest transition in world history. Among the fallen? Bill Richardson, corruption scandal. Tom Daschle, taxes, ethics. Nancy Kleffer, taxes. Annette Nazareth, allegations of incompetence. Carolyn Atkinson, taxes. H. Rodgen Cohen, conflicts of interest. Frank Brozens, personal reasons. Scott Polakoff, allegations of fraud. John Cannon, ties to embezzlement scam. Charles Freeman, foreign government cronyism. And those are just some of the bodies thrown under the bus before the 100-day mark. Heck of a job, Obama vetters. But getting through the confirmation process was no guarantee of ethical cleanliness or competence. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, of course, tops the list of Senate-confirmed Obama bombs. Mentored by Wall Street power brokers Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, he played key roles in bungling Indonesia's economy and engineering the Bear Stearns and AIG bailout fiascos. And that was before his prolonged failure to pay back taxes on illegal immigrant household help, along with his acceptance of reimbursement money for taxes he didn't pay, was discovered, and before his sheepish admission that he had approved the AIG bonuses, his boss decried as shameful and outrageous. After Bill Richardson and GOP Senator Judd Gregg bowed out of the Commerce Secretary position, President Obama settled on former Democrat Governor of Washington, Gary Locke. The national papers called him straight-laced and hailed his clean reputation. Both liberals and conservatives in his home state called that a crock. As governor, he gave billions in tax breaks to Boeing while failing to disclose that he had retained a paid Boeing private consultant and auditor to advise him on the matter. In the governor's mansion, Locke had his own Billy Carter, a brother-in-law who mooched off the family name to secure tax breaks and job opportunities. And on top of all that, the corporate lawyer Locke, who specialized in trade issues with China, was involved in not one, not two, but three campaign finance scandals involving tainted Asian cash. Perhaps suffering from Commerce Secretary withdrawal fatigue, the Senate confirmed Locke by unanimous consent. Hostility to transparency is a running thread through Obama's cabinet. The number two official at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, former King County, Washington executive Ron Sims, has the distinction of being the most fined government official in his state's history for suppressing public records from taxpayers. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for years fought disclosure of massive donations from foreign governments and corporations who filled her husband's library and foundation coffers. Top Obama advisor David Axelrod ran fear-mongering campaigns in Illinois in support of a huge utility rate hike and failed to disclose that his ads were funded by the Commonwealth Edison in Chicago. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis failed to disclose that she was director and treasurer of a union-promoting lobbying group pushing legislation that she was co-sponsoring as a congresswoman. Attorney General Eric Holder overruled his own lawyers in the Justice Department over the issue of D.C. voting rights, which he and President Obama support, and refused to make public the staffer's opinion that a House bill on the matter was unconstitutional. President Obama set the tone, breaking his transparency pledge with the very first bill he signed into law. On January 29, 2009, the White House announced that the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act had been posted online for review. One problem? Obama had already signed it, in violation of his sunlight before signing pledge to post legislation for public comment on the White House website 5 days before he sealed any deal. When there is a bill that ends up on my desk as a president, you, the public, will have 5 days to look online and find out what's in it before I sign it, so that you know what your government's doing, he had vowed. But Obama broke the pledge again with a mad rush to pass his trillion-dollar pork-stuffed stimulus package full of earmarks he denied existed. Jim Harper of the Cato Institute reported in April 2009, of the 11 bills President Obama has signed, only 6 have been posted on whitehouse.gov. None have been posted for a full 5 days after presentment from Congress. The president has signed most bills within a day or two of their presentment from Congress, violating his campaign promise. He assigned two bills more than 5 days after presentment, but ironically, because it preserves the broken promise, not posted them on whitehouse.gov. It's this utter disregard for taxpayer accountability that prompted hundreds of thousands of citizens to take to the streets on Tax Day 2008 for Tea Party protests. The trampling of transparency in the stimulus debate inspired signs that read, "No legislation without deliberation," and "Read the bill first." Obama's response was first to claim that he hadn't even heard of the Tea Party movement, and then, on his 100-day celebration, to deride all those Americans he is supposed to represent of playing games. Projection, anyone? Despite his crusading on disclosure of campaign bundlers, Obama refused to supply occupation and employer information for his top fundraisers. McCain provided the data. And he carried on the tradition of late-night document dumps to minimize scrutiny of his wealthiest cabinet members. Moreover, in a grand end-run around the public confirmation process, President Obama created a historic and unprecedented number of czar appointments through executive orders, essentially creating a shadow cabinet of secretaries overseeing every aspect of domestic policy with unchecked powers beyond congressional reach. Environmental czar Carol Browner, auto czar Stephen Ratner, and health czar Nancy DeParle all have extensive financial ties to the industries they were assigned to oversee, ties that would have progressive supporters of Obama's new politics screaming bloody murder if they had been Republican nominees. Urban czar Adolfo Carrion is in a class of his own. As borough president of the Bronx, he specialized in cash-and-carry deals with developers seeking approval for projects in his district. He received tens of thousands of dollars in donations from the real estate firms just before and after the developers snagged lucrative deals or crucial zoning changes for their projects. In turn, he made millions in public tax dollars available to his cronies. In one case, he arranged for a developer to renovate his front porch and failed to pay him until after his czar appointment. The Hope and Change administration blew off Carrion's critics. On the ObamaBidenChange.gov website, the Ethics Agenda page enshrines a famous quote, "I'm in this race to tell the corporate lobbyists that their days of setting the agenda in Washington are over. I have done more than any other candidate in this race to take on lobbyists and won. They have not funded my campaign. They will not run my White House, and they will not drown out the voices of the American people when I am president." Obama made this bold promise in Des Moines, Iowa in November 2007. A year later, he threw open his transition office in the Oval Office to the nation's leading lobbyists and influence peddlers. Tom Daschle was a lobbyist in everything but technical terms. Attorney General Eric Holder was registered as a lobbyist at Covington and Burling as recently as 2004. Tom Vilsack, the former Iowa governor who was Obama's agriculture secretary, was a registered lobbyist for the National Education Association in 2007. Ron Klain, chief of staff to Vice President Biden, was a lobbyist at O'Melveny and Myers until 2004. Leon Panetta was a lobbyist light who raked in hundreds of thousands of dollars from corporations in consulting fees. Patrick Gaspard, former chief lobbyist for the Service Employees International Union's behemoth New York healthcare affiliate, Local 1199, served as Obama's campaign national political director and transition deputy director of personnel. David Hayes, deputy secretary of the Interior, was a lobbyist at Latham & Watkins through 2006. William Corr, executive director of the nonprofit campaign for tobacco-free kids and a registered lobbyist until September 2008, was Obama's choice for Deputy Health and Human Services Secretary. Former Goldman Sachs lobbyist Mark Patterson was tapped by Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner for Chief of Staff. In the first 2 weeks alone of his infant administration, no lobbyist Obama had made 17 exceptions to his no-lobbyist rule. In the earliest days of the administration, a National Journal reported the White House invoked a clause allowing the Office of Management and Budget Director to waive restrictions to allow former Raytheon lobbyist William Lynn to become Deputy Defense Secretary. And in February, the administration issued two more waivers, one allowing Jocelyn Frey, former General Counsel at the National Partnership for Women and Families, to serve as First Lady Michelle Obama's Director of Policy and Projects, and one clearing the way for Cecilia Munoz, the former senior vice president for the National Council of La Raza, to become White House Director of Intergovernmental Affairs. And that's not counting the spouses and relatives of many of Obama's top officials involved in the favor trading trade, including Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and environmental czar Carol Bronner's husband, whom I document in this book. In short, this is a government of the crony, by the lobbyist, and for all the well-heeled, well-connected people Barack Obama spent his entire campaign demonizing. Obama's defenders will, of course, resort to moral equivalence games. But what about Jack Abramoff? But what about Bush's cronies? But what about Sarah Palin's clothes scandal? But what about John McCain's seven houses? But what about corrupt pay-for-play Republicans like Ted Stevens and former Connecticut Governor John Rowland? Funny they should ask. Jack Abramoff is a slimeball serving 5 to 10 at a gray bar hotel in Maryland. George W. Bush and his cronies, many of whom I vigorously investigated and criticized publicly during the last 8 years, are no longer in office. Taxpayers didn't foot the bill for Sarah Palin's wardrobe or John McCain's seven houses. And the same kind of arrangements involving home renovation freebies from corporate suitors that urban czar Adolfo Carrion got away with resulted in multiple criminal convictions for Stevens and Rowland. Fortunately, not everyone on the left remains paralyzed in an irreversible state of Obama inebriation. This book would not have been possible without the contributions of some brave and lonely liberals, whistleblowers at the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN, and the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, independent journalists and government watchdogs who rejected the excuse-making and whitewashing of Obama's culture of corruption. While Obama sycophants in the mainstream media celebrated his hipness and his swagger, a few principled progressives finally began to question the cult. But they are still in the minority. And there will be more predictable excuses. As I document in this book, Obama's cronies of color, beginning with his own wife, reach for the race card when their dubious judgment is questioned. And when all else fails, there's always the "I inherited the problem" alibi. To which I reply, listen to the book. Barack Obama owns this cabinet of cronies, tax cheats, and crooks. It is his and his alone. In the era of new politics, judge him as you would judge other mere mortals. Judge him not by the company that preceded him. Judge him by the company he keeps. Chapter 1. ONWS, Obama Nominee Withdrawal Syndrome. As America thrilled to the inauguration of its 44th president and a new first lady, the West Wing was filling with a kaleidoscopic army of policy aces, whiz kids, and veteran advisors, all focused on the long haul. No drama work, to which Barack has called them. The enchanted editors of Vanity Fair magazine could not contain their glee. In March 2009, they rolled out a special commemorative inauguration issue, replete with historic portraits of Washington's new establishment, snapped by celebrity photographer Annie Leibovitz. President Obama's fanboys and fangirls at the glossy publication hailed the vibrant diversity of the new guard. Beltway journalist Maureen Orth, who interviewed Obama's kaleidoscopic army for the issue, pronounced herself amazed. She was dazzled not by the audacity of their ideas, but also by their apparent belief that in this stratified and partisan town, they will be able to effect a sea change in attitudes. Vanity Fair editorial associate Julian Sancton squealed, "Together the images in this collection document the dawn of an era. Hold on to this issue. Posterity will thank you." Annie Leibovitz's first group photo showcased Obama's seven A-list cabinet members and nominees. Secretary-designate of Labor Hilda Solis stood with arms akimbo in a hot tomato power suit. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano donned a Garanimal's red turtleneck and beaming smile. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood and Secretary of Veteran Affairs Eric Shinseki both looked relaxed in solid ties and dark suits. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack struck an oddly pensive pose with downcast eyes amid his jubilant peers. Perhaps he has clairvoyant powers. In the far right corner of the class picture, Secretary-designate of the Treasury Timothy Geithner wore shirt sleeves and a furrowed expression of bewilderment, which would soon become his trademark image. And on the far left end of the set, Secretary-designate of Health and Human Services Tom Daschle looked straight into the camera with the toothiest, most self-satisfied grin. This is our opportunity to change the healthcare system in this country for the first time in a comprehensive way, Vanity Fair quoted Daschle in the lead caption on the power portrait. Expectations are very high. We are ready to go. He wasn't kidding. On January 25, 2009, word had already leaked that Daschle had scored a ground floor office in the West Wing. Maureen Orth's accompanying piece, obsequiously titled, Can Obama's New Team Make Government Cool Again?, reiterated the ready-to-go theme. Former Democratic leader in the Senate Tom Daschle, now Secretary of Health and Human Services, vowed to transform health care, the thorniest issue of all. There's a tremendous opportunity to launch this new era in a much more positive tone, he said. Orth's anointing of Daschle, alas, was premature. The supermodel-style photo spread and drool-drenched cabinet profiles were published on the Vanity Fair website at the beginning of February. Daschle was not yet Secretary of Health and Human Services, nor would he, notwithstanding Vanity Fair's unilateral coronation and official portraiture, ever be. On February 3, 2009, Daschle withdrew from the HHS nomination as furious funnel clouds of ethical scandal, conflicts of interest, and tax avoidance darkened White House skies. Old ways doomed new job for Daschle, the Washington Post intoned. Daschle out as health nominee due to tax problems, the Associated Press reported. Daschle ends bid for post, Obama concedes mistake, the New York Times announced. Public expectations may have been very high, to borrow Daschle's words, but the Obama veterans' standards were trapped in a ditch. The Daschle disaster came on the heels of former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson's withdrawal from the Commerce Secretary nomination over a long-running pay-for-play probe in New Mexico, which was followed by disclosure of Treasury Secretary Geithner's tax goofs involving his failure to pay $43,000 in federal self-employment taxes for four separate years until, that is, he was tapped for his Obama post. And these were just the first three of a hapless series of botched nominations involving Obama's policy aces, whiz kids, and veteran advisors. By the end of his first 100 days, Obama had set a turnover record for an incoming cabinet with four major withdrawals, including Republican Senator Judd Gregg's withdrawal as Richardson's replacement at Commerce over fiscal policy disagreements, and a spate of lower posts, such as CNN medical journalist Sanjay Gupta's decision to forego the Surgeon General's post for family and timing reasons. By comparison, former President Bill Clinton had six major nominee dropouts during the course of his eight-year presidency. George W. Bush had two. George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, and Jimmy Carter had one each, according to National Journal. By the hallowed 100-day mark, Obama had announced less than half of the total Senate-confirmed cabinet department positions he needed to fill, and only 10% had been confirmed. Given the fact that Democrats had an overwhelming majority in the Senate, delayed confirmations couldn't be blamed on partisan opposition. Perhaps the new president figured that a disastrously bungled appointment process is the way to make government cool again. The administration's handling of the U.S. ambassadorship to Iraq is in a category all by itself. After being told by Vice President Joe Biden, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and National Security Advisor James L. Jones that he had the job, four-star Marine General Anthony Zinni told The Washington Times in early February 2009 that the appointment had been withdrawn without explanation in favor of a veteran diplomat, Christopher Hill. Hill was confirmed in April 2009. Zinni recounted the disastrous treatment to Foreign Policy's Laura Rosen. To make a long story short, I kept getting blown off all week, Zinni said. Meantime, I was rushing to put my personal things in order to get ready to go. Finally, nobody was telling me anything, Zinni said. I called the National Security Advisor, James L. Jones, Monday several times. I finally got through late in the evening. I asked Jones, what's going on? And Jones said, we decided on Chris Hill. I said, really? Zinni recalled. That was news to me. Jones asked him if he would like to be ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Zinni said. I said, you can stick that with whatever other offers, Zinni recalled, saying he had used more colorful language with Jones. Asked Jones's response, and if he was apologetic, Zinni said, Jones was not too concerned. He laughed about it. Zinni said, particularly galling is that had he not managed to get through to Jones on Monday night after repeated calls, he would have found out about the Chris Hill appointment in the Washington Post the next day with everybody else. You know, I would have appreciated if someone called me and said minds were changed, Zinni said. But not even to get a call, that's what's really embarrassing. Zinni told the New York Times that he was offered the ambassadorship to Saudi Arabia as a consolation prize. I told him to stick it where the sun don't shine. 2 months into the Hope and Change presidency, a popular joke made its way around the internet. What's the difference between Obama and Jesus? Jesus could actually build a cabinet. You never get a second chance to make a first post-inaugural impression. Less than 3 weeks into his first 100 days, Barack Obama left indelible marks on his nascent presidency, the marks of incompetence and hubris. Despite the administration's much-touted wealth of sharp minds and seasoned strategists, the transition was an abject disaster. The myth of no-drama Obama quickly gave way to constant trauma Obama, as nominee withdrawal syndrome bogged down what was allegedly the best and brightest administration in history. Annie Leibovitz didn't stick around to take historic portraits of the unraveling of Washington's new establishment. There's no room in her perfectly airbrushed portfolio to commemorate the unglamorous reality of Team Obama's meltdown, but posterity demands that the discards be framed and memorialized. Call it Calamity Fair. The Rise and Fall of Dollar Bill Richardson. He denied it was a consolation prize, they both did, but the odd couple of New Mexico, Democrat Governor Bill Richardson and Barack Obama, fooled no one. On December 3, 2008, the former rivals for the White House appeared at a news conference in Chicago to announce Richardson's nomination to head the Commerce Department. Governor Richardson is uniquely suited for this role as a leading economic diplomat for America, Obama asserted. As governor of New Mexico, Bill showed how government can act as a partner to support our businesses, said Obama, adding that Richardson would bring a leadership style all his own. In the end, Bill Richardson is a leader who shares my values, the president-elect concluded. More to the point, Richardson was owed. After abandoning his own presidential bid in January 2008, Richardson ditched the Clintons, his old friends and former bosses, to offer a timely endorsement of Obama in March 2008. Richardson happily accepted the nomination with a boilerplate speech about the importance of commerce, spiced up with a bit of Spanish. El resto de la comunidad latina gracias por su apoyo y su confianza, to show off his identity politics contribution of vibrant diversity. Challenged by a Latino reporter on whether the nomination was meant to appease Hispanics, Obama bristled, well, Commerce Secretary's a pretty good job, you know. It's a member of my key economic team that is going to be dealing with the most significant issue that America faces right now, and that is, how do we put people back to work and rejuvenate the economy? Bill Richardson has been selected because he is the best person for that job. I think the notion that somehow the Commerce Secretary is not going to be central to everything we do is fundamentally mistaken. Obama further rejected the suggestion that he was engaging in ethnic tokenism. I think that when people look back and see the entire slate, what they will say is, not only in terms of my cabinet, but in terms of my White House staff, I think people are going to say this is one of the most diverse cabinets and White House staffs of all time. But more importantly, they're going to say, these are all people of outstanding qualifications and excellence. Protesting too much, Obama argued that there's no contradiction between diversity and excellence. I'm looking for the best people, first and foremost to serve the American people. It just so happens that Bill Richardson is one of those people. Best people? Richardson's business experience consisted of serving on several corporate boards after leaving a lifetime of government employment in Washington. Oh, and he was the son of a Citibank executive. His claim to fame during his years as UN ambassador under Bill Clinton, going out of his way to extend a job offer to presidential plaything Monica Lewinsky. His claim to fame during his years as energy secretary under Clinton, botching the espionage case against nuclear scientist Wen-Ho Lee. Shared values? Richardson was infamous for inflating and fudging his personal and political biographies. For almost 40 years, he stoked the myth that he had been drafted as a young pitcher for the Kansas City Athletics. His hometown newspaper, the Albuquerque Journal, reported in 2005 that it never happened. In another disturbing glimpse at his flawed character, Richardson repeatedly exploited the tale of a fallen Marine for self-aggrandizement while on the campaign trail. He told a stump anecdote about a young American Marine from New Mexico, Lance Corporal Aaron Austin, who was killed in Iraq. His mother, Richardson claimed, personally thanked him for obtaining federal death benefits. However, Richardson got the fallen Marine's name and age wrong and completely fabricated the conversation, according to Austin's mother. She demanded an apology. Instead, on Meet the Press, Richardson stood by his story and patted himself on the back again for standing up for veterans. Excellence? Richardson's heavy-handed cronyism had been documented for years by both the right and the left in his home state. His political horse trading with private businesses, campaign donations for infrastructure projects, patronage jobs, and board appointments was so notorious it earned him the moniker Dollar Bill. And as the New Mexico GOP documented in March 2007, Richardson's role in the bankruptcy and securities fraud scandal of fraud-ridden software company Peregrine Systems had been widely publicized. Richardson served on the board of directors of Peregrine Systems from February 2001 to June of 2002, during a period when the company was covering up accounting fraud to the tune of $509 million in overstated profits and $2.6 billion in understated losses. Governor Richardson resigned 2 months after the fraud conspiracy was uncovered by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Governor Richardson is a close family member of former Peregrine president and CEO Stephen P. Gardner, who pleaded guilty on March 13, 2007, to three felony charges of defrauding the company and shareholders out of millions of dollars. The company bankruptcy cost thousands of employees their jobs. Gardner is married to the governor's wife, Barbara Richardson's sister, Dorothy Flavin Gardner. Richardson, who in the past has tried to minimize his role in the implosion of Peregrine, has said he was unaware of the accounting irregularities and only attended about five board meetings during his 16 months on the board. Yet, according to San Diego Reader veteran financial reporter Don Bowder, Richardson was briefed several times on the accounting meltdown inside the company. According to Bowder, Richardson attended 15 board meetings either in person or by telephone. Bowder has nicknamed Governor Richardson Dollar Bill. In those meetings, directors were hearing that the company might get caught cooking the books. For example, Richardson attended the meeting of July 18, 2001. The company's chief executive, Stephen Gardner, the brother-in-law of Richardson's wife, informed board members of a barter transaction that had occurred with Critical Path, a Bay Area company headed by a Rancho Santa Fe executive known around Peregrine as FOJ, friend of John Moore's. In the same article, Bowder also wrote that directors were told that the Securities and Exchange Commission had questioned three Peregrine top executives and a national business magazine was on the story. Directors discussed how to spin it. John Moores, a real estate mogul and owner of the San Diego Padres, had also reportedly been a campaign contributor to Richardson's re-election campaign. According to an article in the San Diego Union Tribune, Moore sold or transferred more than $487 million worth of Peregrine shares, though he hasn't been charged or implicated in the government's investigation. On the other side of the political aisle, liberal magazine Mother Jones had also called attention to Richardson's shady role in the Peregrine system scandal, which the publication in 2007 dubbed a financial scam in the Enron style. On top of all that, Richardson was the subject of a high-profile probe and ongoing grand jury investigation into whether he traded New Mexico government contracts for campaign contributions. The White House transition team knew about the pay-to-play scandal involving a California company, CDR Financial Productions well before Obama unwisely fated Richardson's ability to show how government can act as a partner to support our businesses. FBI and federal prosecutors launched their probe of CDR's activities in New Mexico in the summer of 2008. The feds had been digging into a nationwide web of favor trading between financial firms and politicians overseeing local government bond markets. CDR was tied to a doomed bond deal in Alabama, which, according to Bloomberg News, threatened to cause the biggest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. CDR raked in nearly $1.5 million in fees from a New Mexico State financial agency after donating more than $100,000 to Richardson's efforts to register Hispanic and American Indian voters and to pay for expenses at the 2004 Democratic National Convention, the news service reported. The state agency that awarded the money consisted of five Richardson appointees and five members of his gubernatorial cabinet. CDR made contributions both shortly before and after securing consultant work with the state of New Mexico. CDR's president also contributed $29,000 to Obama's presidential campaign. It took 33 days before Team Obama threw Richardson and his ethical baggage off the bus. On January 4, 2009, Richardson announced his withdrawal. "Let me say unequivocally that I and my administration have acted properly in all matters and that this investigation will bear out that fact," he told NBC News. "But I've concluded that the ongoing investigation also would have forced an untenable delay in the confirmation process." Obama gave the obligatory send-off. "It is a measure of his willingness to put the nation first that he has removed himself as a candidate for the cabinet to avoid any delay in filling this important economic post at this critical time. But it is a measure of Obama's obliviousness that he nominated the ethically challenged Richardson in the first place." Mother Jones writer James Ridgway's comment on the day of Richardson's withdrawal proved quite prescient. "It may be premature to say that Obama and his team have too high a tolerance for corruption, but this first self-destruct among his cabinet picks could well prove all the more damaging because it's something they should have seen coming from miles away." Driving Tom Daschle. In 1998, then-Minority Leader Tom Daschle read a bold statement on the Senate floor condemning tax cheats. "Make no mistake," the Democrat politician said emphatically, "tax cheaters cheat us all, and the IRS should enforce our laws to the letter." He also crusaded righteously against Benedict Arnold corporations that earned income overseas to avoid high corporate tax rates in the United States. Daschle had zero tolerance for tax evaders. Fast forward to January 31, 2009. The New York Times reported that Daschle was aware as early as last June 2008 that he might have to pay back taxes for the use of a car and driver provided by a private equity firm, but did not inform the Obama transition team until weeks after Mr. Obama named him to the health secretary's post in mid-December 2008. Daschle was on the cusp of attaining enormous power to reshape the American economy and implement his sweeping universal health care proposals. He wasn't going to let a pesky tax omission get in the way. On January 2, 2009, he had been forced to amend his 2005 and 2007 tax returns to reflect $255,256 for the use of the car service, $83,000 in unreported consulting income, and $14,963 in charitable contributions. In addition, the would-be Health and Human Services Secretary failed to pay $6,000 in Medicare taxes for the driver. On February 1, 2009, Daschle graveled before his former Senate colleagues to explain away the back payments he owed, as well as dubious charitable deductions worth an estimated $146,000, including interest and penalties. "Sorry," worked for tax cheat Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. "Why not Daschle, too?" his hangdog letter read. "As you can well imagine, I am deeply embarrassed and disappointed by the errors that required me to amend my tax returns. I apologize for the errors and profoundly regret that you have had to devote time to them. Last fall, when I was being considered for this position, the presidential transition team's vetters reviewed my records. During the course of those reviews, the vetting team flagged charitable contributions they felt were deducted in error. When my accountant realized I would need to file amended returns, he suggested addressing another matter I had raised with him earlier in the year, whether the use of a car service offered to me by a close friend might be a tax issue. In December, my accountant advised me that it should be reported as imputed income in the amended returns. At about the same time, the friend's company, a consulting client, informed my accountant of a clerical error it had made on the Form 1099 it provided to me and reported to the IRS for 2007. In an effort to ensure full compliance and the most complete disclosure possible of my personal finances, we remedied these issues by filing amended tax returns with full payments, including interest. We provided all this information to the committee in addition to the completed committee questionnaire and my responses to your staff's questions. I disclosed this information to the committee voluntarily and paid the taxes and any interest owed promptly. My mistakes were unintentional. The national media seemed ready to downplay the unbelievable lapses. A Washington Post headline characterized the problem as a tax glitch. A glitch is checking off the wrong box or misspelling a name. This was an ethical morass. The donor and personal friend who provided the chauffeured services, Leo Hendry Jr., had also made Daschle chairman of the Executive Advisory Board of Intermedia Advisors, a high-flying investment firm. Daschle raked in $1 million salary from the arrangement in addition to his private chariot. Asked why he hadn't disclosed the cozy arrangement, Daschle told committee staff he had grown used to having a car and driver as majority leader and did not think to report the perk on his taxes, according to staff members. It was a perfect expression of the culture of Beltway entitlement. Obama stuck by Daschle, one of his earliest champions and closest advisors, that day. "Absolutely," the president-elect responded when asked if he still supported the nomination. At a press briefing that afternoon, White House spokesman Robert Gibbs dismissed Daschle's tax evasion. "Nobody's perfect." But in 24 short hours, Obama was singing a different tune. CBS News rounded up the White House "I'm Sorry" media tour. During interviews with CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox, and CNN, President Obama was asked about the cabinet staffing hiccup. The typically confident president repeatedly said that the appointment scandal was his responsibility and apologized over and over again. "I believe on Tom's part that, you know, ordinary people are out there paying taxes every day, and whether it's an intentional mistake or not, it was sending the wrong signal," he told Couric. "So again, this was something that was my fault. I've got to own up to my mistake, which is that ultimately it's important for this administration to send a message that there aren't two sets of rules, you know, one for prominent people and one for ordinary folks who have to pay their taxes," Mr. Obama told NBC. "I'm frustrated with myself, with our team," he added, "and I'm here on television saying I screwed up. And that's part of the era of responsibility. It's not never making mistakes, it's owning up to them and trying to make sure you never repeat them, and that's what we intend to do." ABC's Charles Gibson asked President Obama what type of message he thought investigations into three of his appointees' taxes sent. Responded the president, "Well, I think it sends the wrong one, and that's, you know, something I take responsibility for. I think I made a mistake, and I told Tom that. I take responsibility for the appointees," Mr. Obama told CNN. "I think my mistake is not in selecting Tom originally, but I think that, look, ultimately I campaigned on changing Washington and bottom-up politics, and I don't want to send a message to the American people that there are two sets of standards, one for powerful people and one for ordinary folks who are working every day and paying their taxes." And just to make sure no audience members were missed, the apologetic president told Fox News, "I take responsibility for this mistake." He promised to make sure we're not screwing up again. In total, President Obama said the word mistake 12 times during the 5 interviews. He also used the phrase "I take responsibility" 3 times and the word "regret" twice. It was a little late to be worrying about sending a bad message to the American people about double standards, but only the blessed Barack Obama could have national media outlets describing this fiasco of the first order as a cabinet staffing hiccup. The Daschle nomination was a Shrek-sized stink bomb from start to finish. The limousine liberals' tax evasions were the least of his problems. Tom Daschle is the personification of all that Obama professed to detest during his campaign of hope and change, a consummate Beltway insider who parlayed his public service where he earned a $158,000 yearly salary into a $5.2 million personal fortune as one of Washington's biggest influence peddlers, along with his lobbyist wife. Did Obama forget that GOP Senator John Thune defeated Daschle the Dodger in 2004 after news broke of Daschle's bogus property tax homestead exemption claim on his $1.9 million D.C. mansion, which he listed as his primary residence despite voting in South Dakota, claiming it in order to run for re-election? Did Obama forget that Daschle worked for the legal and lobbying firm Alston & Byrd, scratching backs, making phone calls, offering advice, trading on his name and connections, and doing everything short of registering as a lobbyist? President Obama bashed corporate executives for flying in lavish planes, even as the Senate Finance Committee was investigating his HHS nominee's repeat flights and the $31 million luxury jet of a scandal-ridden educational charity called EduCap, owned by one of the Daschle's closest friends, Catherine Reynolds. Even without the tax issue, the Daily Telegraph's Toby Harden correctly noted, Daschle is the kind of guy who epitomizes the Washington way of doing things, the broken politics that during his campaign Obama promised to sweep away. Nevertheless, Obama steadfastly praised Daschle's devotion to public service. The president expressed sadness and regret that his nominee got tripped up by his mistake, but not an iota of remorse to the American people for his lack of good sense and judgment in nominating his wheeler-dealer beltway buddy in the first place. Performance czar Nancy Clifford takes a dive. Just hours before the jaw-dropping Daschle announcement came the withdrawal of Nancy Clifford. She was tapped to be President Obama's chief performance officer, overseeing compliance, organizational effectiveness, and waste management across every federal agency. Obama had also asked her to serve as deputy director at the Office of Management and Budget. But the former Clinton Treasury official and head of the Washington office of the prestigious management consulting firm McKinsey & Company, Incorporated, couldn't be bothered to manage her own household help effectively. While she climbed the corporate ladder, she hired two nannies and a personal assistant to manage affairs at home, where her economics professor husband and two children lived. The management guru failed for a year and a half to pay employment taxes on her household help and had an outstanding $1,000 tax lien on her home. Degrees out the wazoo, the woman whose reputation rested on her meticulousness with numbers did not have enough smarts to care to dot her I's and cross her T's on her own tax forms in a town that had been through several infamous nannygate crises during the past two administrations. Mimicking her would-be boss's penchant for playing the distraction card when caught in an ethical pickle, Clifford issued a withdrawal statement that deflected blame to those who took tax lapses seriously. "I recognize that your agenda and the duties facing your chief performance officer are urgent. I have also come to realize in the current environment that my personal tax issue of D.C. unemployment tax could be used to create exactly the kind of distraction and delay those duties must avoid." White House spokesman Robert Gibbs blithely insisted the day after the Clifford and Daschle withdrawals, "The bar that we set is the highest that any administration in the country has ever set." It was getting harder to listen to such lofty claims every week without hearing a laugh track or drum rim shot. Bailing out at Treasury. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner probably savored the Vanity Fair photo shoot more than any of the other cabinet members. He hasn't had that much company since taking office. By mid-March 2009, only one of 15 key Treasury Department positions requiring Senate confirmation had been filled. Treasury officials denied there were any vetting problems, but Mr. Lonely saw at least five staff picks withdraw before the Obama administration had reached the 100-day mark. On March 5th, Geithner's choice for chief deputy, Annette Nazareth, dropped out of the running after drawing criticism of what some considered to be a lax oversight of the banking industry, the Associated Press reported. She had served as a former senior staffer and commissioner with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, where she founded the Consolidated Securities Entities Program. According to the Wall Street Journal, the Consolidated Securities Entities Program was created in 2004 to coax global investment banks to voluntarily submit to regulation. The five major investment banks that participated in the program no longer exist. The program was abandoned in September 2008, the Journal reported, after then-SEC Chairman Christopher Cox declared it fundamentally flawed from the beginning. In addition, SEC Inspector General David Kotz faulted the SEC program for failing to respond to numerous potential red flags at Bear Stearns, which collapsed in 2008. It also failed to detect the $50 billion Ponzi scheme engineered by convicted mega-swindler Bernie Madoff. The same day, White House aides acknowledged that Carolyn Atkinson, the Treasury pick for Undersecretary for International Affairs, had withdrawn after a tax problem was discovered in the vetting process. A week after Nazareth and Atkinson bowed out, New York attorney H. Rodgen Cohen withdrew his bid to replace Nazareth. Cohen was a preeminent counsel to Wall Street firms and a partner at prestigious Sullivan & Cromwell LLP, which had donated nearly $242,000 to the Democratic National Committee during the 2008 campaign cycle. Democratic sources told ABC News an issue arose in the final stages of the vetting process. The issue may well have been Cohen's hands-on role as a primary engineer of the very banking crisis he was nominated to help fix. The Wall Street Journal noted in the fall of 2008 that Cohen helped mold the financial system that is now under assault, helped draft the rules that led to the emergence of powerful national banks, waged the first hostile bank takeover in the U.S., lobbied to expand the Federal Reserve's power to provide the emergency loans now being employed by the government, and helped broker the deal that put Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into conservatorship. Yes, it certainly would have been an issue if Geithner's top deputy pick were approved for office, only to be forced to recuse himself from every aspect of his job over conflicts of interest. On March 24, 2009, hedge fund manager Frank Brazens withdrew his name from consideration for the Treasury job overseeing the $700 billion bank bailout program, surprising many who expected him to take the position. Obama economic advisor Larry Summers lobbied on Brazens' behalf. Brazens, a Goldman Sachs alum who was a $200,000-plus fundraising bundler for Obama and actively campaigned for the candidate, abruptly jumped ship, citing personal reasons. On March 26, 2009, another Treasury official took a fall, at a time when Tim Geithner could ill afford to lose any of the few staffers actually working in the department with him. Scott Polakoff, the acting director of the Office of Thrift Supervision, was put on an undetermined leave pending a review of the agency's role in the backdating of capital infusions by some banks. The late-night announcement indicated that Polakoff's office allowed at least six instances of apparent bookcooking on behalf of IndyMac and other banks, so that earlier quarterly financial statements looked healthier than they would have. In addition, Polakoff's agency was faulted for lax oversight of bailout behemoth AIG. President Bush originally appointed Polakoff to his post, but this wasn't merely an inherited problem. President Obama made the decision to promote Polakoff in February 2009. In early March 2009, Polakoff testified before a Senate banking committee that his office should have exercised its authority in 2004 to stop AIG's troubled financial products division from engaging in risky derivatives and credit default swaps. Polakoff hasn't been heard from publicly since. EPA deputy nominee John Cannon's rough waters. And the hits kept coming. On February 23, 2009, the White House heralded the nomination of John Cannon for the Deputy U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator slot. Cannon was a law professor at the University of Virginia. Less than a month later, Cannon voluntarily removed his name from consideration for the post. It has come to my attention that America's Clean Water Foundation, where I once served on the board of directors, has become the subject of scrutiny, he acknowledged in a brief statement. While my service on the board of that now-dissolved organization is not the subject of the scrutiny, I believe the energy and environmental challenges facing our nation are too great to delay confirmation for this position, and I do not wish to present any distraction to the agency. The withdrawal was abrupt and curious. For the past month, he had been working in Washington as a member of the Obama transition team and had prepared to leave his job in academia. An EPA report from 2007 documented how the America's Clean Water Foundation mishandled three huge governmental grants totaling nearly $26 million. The foundation could not provide support for any of its general journal entries. Two, included duplicate transactions in its accounting system. Three, recorded labor charged to EPA grants incorrectly. Four, could not support the recorded indirect costs. 5. Claimed unallowable pre-award costs. 6. Recorded EPA cash draws inaccurately. 7. Did not submit required indirect cost proposals to EPA. 8. Did not complete the required single audits for fiscal years ended June 30, 2003, June 30, 2004, and June 30, 2005. And 9. Did not submit a federal cash transactions report when required. The Foundation's procurement practices and procedures did not comply with the grant regulations. The Foundation awarded sole source contracts without performing the cost price analysis required by Title 40 CFR 3045. It also awarded a contract to a member of its board of directors contrary to the conflict of interest provisions at Title 40 CFR 3042 and reimbursed a contractor for billings above contractual ceilings.